time schedule in terms of everything that I'm trying to do. And I'm told I didn't watch this. I'm told Bafana Bafana won by wider margin last night. So they found their scoring booth finally. We wish them well. It's a sign of encouragement and good things to come. But nonetheless, we still have got our own business here. As honorable members and the professionals in every discipline of our spheres of life. And that is why we're sitting here. But I'm told from the time people start kicking the round thing, the leather, life will come to a standstill. We'll be in a celebratory mood, all of us. Yeah, so let's look forward for that. We have for this hearings, which is more about the taxation laws amendments as presented by the minister earlier this year. We have people from the National Treasury present here. The first presentation will come from our, I always see him, you know, this time of the year, Professor Osman. And I think that's the presentation that we're going to start with for today. We're trying to make sure that we allow National Treasury the space and the necessary space to do further work post today's hearing. It's a normal engagement process to clarify and come back to us at a later stage on the consensus that you also reach. Because as a country, we've established a very progressive system of engagement. We try to reach consensus with the stakeholders in whatever we do. And it has worked well for the South African government, South African population, and the citizens. You're going to leave, Prof? Okay. All right. David Lema. Okay. Over to you. Maybe just before you start, I saw one a gentleman inquiring this morning, some 2 minutes ago, checking whether we are going to deal with the South African Reserve Bank matter today. But the public hearings are starting tomorrow on that matter. But you are welcome to sit through this process. Okay. Bradley, everybody is supposed to be in here, is in this hall, and everyone also supposed to be is outside. Okay. All right. Over to you, Prof.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. With pleasure. There you go. Thank you. I must admit, I was also wondering whether I'd be prefer to be listening to the radio to see which five players after five goals were dropped, but I now have to wait till we finish. But so in that case, we will try and be very fast so that we can see exactly who's going to be playing next week. But again, thank you. I have to say, this is an incredible process. We've been part of the process for many years, and as you quite rightly said, it's progressive. It's a meeting of minds, and generally speaking, and I have no doubt it will happen again this year, the interaction of the taxpayer, the professional firms with National Treasury and SARS have always come up with perhaps not always the answers that the taxpayers want, but it certainly has created much better law. and therefore this is a system that I think one can hold up and be very proud of. We're going to, first of all, just focus today on 10 issues and really on policy matters. There will be a detailed representation that will go in, which will be quite bulky and will go through to SARS and National Treasury with a copy to the committee that will give very detailed reps, and that will go in before the deadline of the 11th of June. But for today, we want to focus on what we believe are our key issues that we would like the committee to address. We apologise that it's not in the order of the explanatory memorandum, but you will see that each slide does have a reference to the bill and the explanatory memorandum. And as I said, we'll only deal with 10 issues. I think that there are two points we want to make up front. One is that historically and in this bill, little concern or perhaps clarity on National Treasury and SARS strategy. Because sometimes we see provisions coming through that are so outlandish that we think to ourselves, is this a negotiating stance? Start off by seeing, testing the water, seeing how people react to this, and then after pulling the noose quite tight, relaxing the rein and coming back a bit. We're not convinced that that really should be the approach. It doesn't happen often, but it does appear to happen each year on a couple of the provisions, and we get to those. The other significant development is the new initiatives on Gateway into Africa. And here I think government really needs to be applauded, and the ministry, because it's now focusing not just on our companies that go overseas, but saying how do we win the space of being the hub for Africa, and how do we make our tax system not a barrier but an attraction for people to use the significant infrastructure that we already have here. And we'll deal slightly more with that in a minute. So we're going to go through 10 issues. Those are the 10 issues. I think to start off with, unfortunately, the very short consultation period between when the bill is released and our coming to provide reps seems to happen every year, and every year we ask, shouldn't there be a little bit longer so that people can come prepared? It could be that the 80-20 rule is working, because you'll see that I'm sure the standard of presentations will be quite good, and they are every year. But again, we came in just on the 21 days. I think it was released at 6 o'clock on the 10th of May, and here we are dealing with it on having in by yesterday, the 31st of May. If seasoned tax practitioners find it difficult to deal with the volume of legislation and amendments and what the words actually mean, I think it creates a lot of pressure on the process to be in that position and to be able to listen now and understand what's happening. And I think it's even more important this year, because the key difference this year is that the money bill can be amended. And historically, the bill would come through, and as a committee, you can either accept the bill or throw the bill out. You can only do it in a whole, as a whole. But this year is a time when if you see a specific provision that you feel is not appropriate, you have the authority to request a change. And I feel that that actually creates more pressure than in the past, because before, you just had to be happy that on balance the whole act was okay. But now it's actually, are the specific provisions okay? And I'm very grateful, in fact, for the World Cup, because it's giving us a breathing space to actually look this first time when the legislation is coming through, and we have, I believe, an additional onus on the process. We've said every year that there needs to be a rebuttal stage. I think that it's even more important now that one has that, where if there is a specific provision that is causing problems, it can be dealt with in isolation. Let's see, there we go. I'll now turn across to Professor Malaji.
Thanks, David. The second and last of our more general points, which really does go to many of the specific points we're going to discuss after this, is really about the current status, or really the fate, I think I should say, of our general anti-avoidance rules in the Income Tax Act. And the reason we raise this is because every year, and without exception, every year, we see our tax law becoming increasingly complicated by a proliferation of specific anti-avoidance rules. I mean, we know the cat and mouse game that we all try and avoid, but we know about it, that you have sophisticated taxpayers coming up with loopholes and SARS and National Treasury having to try and plug them. And we understand that and respect that. That is a reality. But we have what we thought was a relatively, well, I suppose the jury's out on this, a relatively good general anti-avoidance rule that was supposed to be this kind of catch-all that would really deter taxpayers from coming up with abusive or impermissible tax avoidance schemes. But what we're seeing instead is that that provision is not being used at all. It's not being used at all, and rather, every time we see a specific specific tax avoidance threat, where you know, trot out another set of specific anti-avoidance rules. Our opposition to this is something that we place on record almost every year. Last year we didn't have a specific slide on this, and we didn't make it a specific point. But I do want to raise this again. We need to think about the complexity of our tax system and the impact that the specific anti-avoidance rules have. Are we going to move to a scenario where we're going to end up having a tax act that has 1,000 sections in it? Or are we going to try and apply what we already have? The other point that I just wanted to make, and I think we're going to come up with specific comments on this, is that one of the big problems with specific anti-avoidance rules is that they should be targeted. If you see someone doing something bad, you should direct it at them specifically. But that is very, very difficult, and you always end up hurting the innocent bystanders. People who are not abusive taxpayers, people who do want to pay their tax, they get hurt because we are not able to narrow down enough the specific anti-avoidance rules. So this is another reason why we need to avoid it.
I just wanted to make the comment that it's actually one about strategy. If you allow GAR to take effect and have the courts deal with it, in 5 years' time, you will have a comprehensive, practical GAR that will be far more flexible and will prevent impermissible tax avoidance far better than what we're doing at the moment each year, creating another little anti-avoidance section. And this is what we're suggesting. We're saying that one should consider the strategy of going for GAR and using the court, because in the medium term we will be far better off than the short term gains we seem to be getting.
Point before we move on. It was one of the, I think it might have been someone in this room, I don't know, who 2 years ago said, let's start applying the GAR, put it out to the court, and, you know, in 5 years' time, we won't still be in the situation where everyone says we don't know what it means and we don't have sufficient case law. But now we are 2 or 3 years later, we still don't have this GAR being applied. We still don't have significant cases to help us interpret it. Okay, then moving on to this, our third point, which is the first of our specific submissions, and this is the proposed withdrawal of the interest exemption for natural persons. Just a little quick bit of background. Most of us will know that for natural persons earning interest, there is currently it's around 22 or 23,000 rand exemption. The first 22 or 23,000 of interest every year is exempt from tax. The proposal is to restrict this so that only people who earn interest from things like government bonds, listed debentures, bank deposits, they will still be entitled to the exemption. But people who invest directly in, you know, make private loans to individuals, and more specifically, and this goes to my first point, who invest directly into small businesses, for example, will no longer have that exemption. So my first concern here is that if I'm an investor who has cash, I can either put it in the bank, or I can fund a small business This makes the decision very easy. I give it to the bank because it is less favorable to fund a small business. So this discouraging of the small business sector is one of my concerns. Just keep in mind that in South Africa, in the small business environment, a lot of our small businesses don't have access to bank funds, and they rely on individuals funding them. So that's my first point. My second point really is the explanatory memorandum says there's a concern about this distortion where you have a mismatch, where you have things being, you know, not taxed on the one hand but giving tax relief on the other hand. The theory here is that if I make a loan to someone, that person can deduct it for income tax purposes, but while at the same time I don't get taxed on the interest. I think overstated is to put it kindly, that distortion, because it really ignores the fundamental distortion that is already existing and has for decades existed in our SA tax system. People complain about it, but we've never had submissions about it, and that is the fact that already you have a distortion the other way. Everyone sitting here, or the majority of us sitting here, will have personal loans and home loans. The person receiving the interest is taxed on it, but you who are paying the interest, you don't get any relief for it. So that distortion of interest being taxed on the one hand in the hands of the recipient, but not providing tax relief for the one who's paying it, that already exists. This the current exemption goes a very small way in fixing that. But to say, well, we're going to really restrict that exemption now because it's creating a distortion, I think is really ignoring the fact of the big distortion we have at the moment. Then, a similar point, and this is the proposal to, in the same way that I just spoke about natural persons now, to restrict the interest exemption for non-residents. The current rule is that if non-residents provide funds, make loans into South Africa, the interest that they earn from the South African borrowers is exempt. There's a general rule. It's been like that for about 20 years. And the proposal now, again, is to restrict that exemption. The message, this is the first message, I think, that concerns me the most, is that we are effectively saying to non-residents, to foreign funders, if you want to put your money in South Africa, put it into bonds, put it into listed debentures, don't put it into direct foreign investment. So if you have a company with real operations in South Africa, if you lend to that company, you don't get the exemption. I mean, I must point out that that's not necessarily the case, because you'll have clever people who will try and ensure that you do end up not paying tax, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But this is the scary message that entered my mind when I first saw this proposal. My second point is that the expansion memorandum does say, look, we're concerned about tax abuses and the round-tripping of interest, and I think that's right. But if we look at the totality of the other provisions, the other amendments that are proposed this time around, those concerns are definitely adequately addressed. We have thin capitalization rules. We have proposals to restrict the dividend exemption for foreign dividends coming in. So the perceived abuses really are taken care of, in my view. My third point just on this is that we talk about removing the interest exemption, and it's targeting certain abuses. If we look at those abuses, the removal of the interest exemption or the restriction of the interest exemption is going to be pretty ineffective, because people lending from treaty countries or people with their own interest expenses in their own local jurisdictions are unlikely to be deterred by the restriction of the exemption. It does become slightly more complex, but it is, I think my point is that it is relatively easily avoided. My final point is a message to South African taxpayers and to the South African Revenue Service. How can we have a provision that is almost impossible to police? What we are saying to foreign funders, if you live outside South Africa and you lend money into South Africa, and the only thing that you do is earn interest on your loan, you will now be forced to register as a South African taxpayer, file a South African tax return, pay provisional tax in South Africa. For those foreign funders who choose not to do that, even though technically they should if this law carries, how will SARS police this? I mean, if we have a provision that can't be policed, what's the point of it? It's just bad legislation. We should avoid it. And I suppose as a final point, this entire proposal is not entirely without merit. I think we do recognize that. From an administrative perspective, I suppose our final comment is, my final comment is just scrap this proposal. But if there was an alternative kind of comment, it would be just take this off the table for now. Go back and do some homework on imposing instead a withholding tax, and that will be easier to apply.
I think, in a nutshell, this one does appear to be looking at short-term investment flows as opposed to investment in business. So it seems to be coming from the wrong starting point. Globally, that we must be aware, there is a focus on lending and there is a focus on thin capitalization and making sure that groups aren't overborrowed. And historically, we heard, this has been around for 20 years, so this is a major change in our tax system. And it used to be very much used as a way of saying to foreign investors that our tax system does not highly tax and is not quite effectively because interest is not taxed in South Africa in the hands of the non-resident. So we need to think carefully about this and at the same time make sure that like other countries, because other countries are focusing on this, and it is important that we don't have excessive interest flows out. And in that respect, this type of provision is correct. The result is probably right. What is wrong is the way in which we're trying to achieve it by trying to create a proposal that cannot actually be enforced and therefore would undermine the system as opposed to protect it. In other jurisdictions, they would consider a withholding tax regime, which is where Osman finished off.
The new proposed Section 23K seeks to automatically disallow the interest deduction if you earn exempt income like dividends. So the point is that if you run a business, but you also buy shares from which you earn dividend income, the fact that you earn dividend income automatically disqualifies a portion of your interest expense. If you run a business and you have borrowings on which you pay interest, a portion of your interest will automatically be disqualified. Now, the principle of disqualifying some interest, I think, is sound. It really is a well-established principle in South African tax law. Again, our concern here is the very simplistic and broad way in which this provision is intended to work. First of all, there's a rebuttable presumption, and the rebuttal, in other words, the onus on the taxpayer, depends on their ability to trace the original source of their funds. So if I have shares that I bought, can I prove exactly where I got the money from to buy those shares? And the last time we were here, we were told, look, we've had discussions with the banks, and their systems are sufficiently sophisticated for them to trace. And that's fine, and even if you read the expansion memorandum, it talks about banks and uses banks as an example. So our concern is that we talk about banks in the banking industry, but this provision doesn't apply to banks only, it applies to everyone. So the broad application is my first concern here. The second point is that it really deals with the denial very simplistically. It ignores fundamental income tax principles that you need to ask why. Why did you borrow the funds? This simply says it doesn't matter why you borrowed the funds. If you have a share investment, then you're in trouble. The problem that this creates and how simplistic it is that if I have an investment in shares and today I get a big dividend payout from that investment, then I'm in trouble. A lot of my interest will be denied. And I keep that same investment next year and I get no dividend payout, then suddenly all my interest is deductible. There's no denial. So it's got nothing to do with why I borrowed the funds and what I used the funds for. It's got to do with what do I end up earning. And on that same point, it does mean that dividends that I have control over, so if I have control over a company and I can influence how much dividends they pay out, I'll simply won't take the dividends, which is a problem from a currency perspective. If we look at control over foreign subsidiaries or foreign investments generally, we want to encourage holders of foreign investments to repatriate their funds. This says, if you leave your funds offshore, your South African interest will remain deductible in full, but as soon as you start bringing them in and you have a foreign dividend exemption, as soon as your foreign dividends are exempt and you brought them into South Africa, then you've just shot yourself in the foot by limiting your interest deduction. So I think from my tone there, my closing comment is this proposal needs to be rethought. And as I said in the beginning, the principle is sound, but the way it's being applied or intended to be applied is too simplistic.
And I think once the committee has an idea of the other representations and things like that, it will be important to identify those specific ones that are that the committee feels are important and focus on those because of the way the law now allows you to focus on a specific one and to determine whether you feel it is appropriate that it should be there or be rethought.
Okay, my next point is about employee share schemes, and this is where employees are given shares in the companies that they work for. This proposal says that if you get dividends on those shares, those dividends will be taxed. And just as a little bit of background, dividends for everyone else generally is exempt. It's not taxable. But if you are an employee and you've got shares from the company, then those dividends will be taxed. Now, again, I think the principle is sound. The argument in the explanatory memorandum is this is just like the company paying remuneration to an employee. So it really should be taxed on the same basis. I think that is debatable. I won't debate it here. My point really is that, okay, that's fine. If you want to treat it like salary or any remuneration, then there should be equity in tax treatment, which means that the recipient is taxed, but it also means that the payer should get relief, should have a deduction for the payment. The current proposal simply means that there'll be double taxation. The recipient will be taxed, and the payer, the company paying out the dividend, gets no relief for that payment. So our call here is for the introduction of a deduction to ensure that the employer companies do get a deduction for the dividends they pay out, specifically on the share scheme payments. There are a couple of other technical points, but we'll raise those directly with National Treasury and so on.
This is probably the most complex slide, and I think, as we were saying before, this is an incredible year. We've got the World Cup, we've got these new powers, and at the same time, we have government introducing incentives to actually make us the hub in Africa. You know, never before have I seen tax legislation so directly linked to growing the economy. I mean, that's a bit unfair, because obviously there has, but this one is so targeted, the headquarter company, this one being focused on funds, on saying to funds, we've got the infrastructure, we've got the logistics, come here and we will ensure that we provide you with tax certainty. And I mean, it's brilliant. Having said that, because it's so brilliant, the last thing we should do is put in legislation that doesn't hit the target. And what we have at the moment, and we're discussing this with National Treasury, and from our discussions, again, very sympathetic, this is work in progress. This is the first time it's happened. The legislation as it stands at the moment is very South African, and it helps the South African industry. But the incentive is not just to help South Africa and help it reduce its costs, which this legislation will do. It's there to attract foreign funds and foreign investors. And unfortunately, just as a South African won't go to a British insurer and get his insurance there, a foreigner won't invest in a fund that he's not used to. And when we've looked at this, if we've been looking very recently at the US and the large funds there, they invest generally in what they call limited liability partnerships, which is a specific limited liability vehicle that protects the investor. And they are used to it, and they want to invest in that. If we are going to introduce legislation to attract foreign investment, we need to make sure that the legislation is wide enough to give the foreign investor the vehicle he's used to using, because they won't come and use a South African vehicle that they've never heard of. And as I said, very much work in progress. But the beauty is that this is part of the budget mandate. We will have this legislation. We will have this incentive. And therefore, as I said, work in progress. The other incredibly disappointing thing about this legislation is that it's only effective for years of assessment commencing on or after 1st of January 2011. And I have to say, why? After putting all this work in, all this intelligence, and focusing and really getting people excited, especially at this time when the world's view is upon us. Let's bring it in, years of assessment commencing on or after 1st of January 2010. You know, let's give the foreign investors, let's get out there and win that income and investment. Really, as you can hear, this is an incredible move on the part of the government and needs to be supported. This is a small issue, or it's not so small, but it applies essentially to the general man in the street, in that there's been various increases in our allowances and rebates for inflation, but unfortunately there is quite a significant number of items which are listed in our specific rep, so donations tax, CGT, pension fund and RAF contributions, travel allowance ceiling, bursaries, micro business thresholds, small business corporations, all those things which where there hasn't been an adjustment to the exemption threshold, which means that suddenly, because of inflation, income that Robin taxed last year is now being taxed. So it's essentially creating an increase in the tax charge for those sorts of areas, and we're just highlighting that that really should have an automatic increase in line with inflation to avoid fiscal drag.
I just want to add to what David said. I mean, we know it. We're in tough economic times, and there's pressure on the fiscal to collect, but the big danger here is that if you start pulling more and more of the lower taxpayers into the tax net, and you start accumulating a backlog in later years, it means that you need to give away so much more just to restore the parity you had before.
Almost at the end there, the one but last comment, and this is on the transfer pricing. Again, very good amendments. This is essentially bringing our legislation, which was very much South African, into line with international law and treaties, which our legislation focused on the transaction itself and the gross income, whereas overseas one looks at whether the profit you're making is that which you would expect to receive if you were having a transaction between two independent parties. Transfer pricing is essentially legislation that applies when there is a company or in South Africa and a non-resident and they are connected. So, for example, part of the same group, and they manipulate the price to get the best tax advantage. And this law was outdated, and we applaud it being modernized. But one of the biggest practical difficulties is that there is a huge backlog of audits and cases, and that is because we have penalty provisions. If an adjustment is made, it's viewed as a dividend, and STC is payable on that dividend at 10%, which means that your effective rate will be 38%, and you have interest. We are not suggesting that we should say it's no longer a deemed dividend. All we're saying is that the revenue should be given the authority to waive the STC in appropriate circumstances. Just give them the power so that they can do the deal better and quicker. Because at the moment, the cost is so high that parties are simply digging their heels in, creating a backlog, and that's not good for the system or anyone, taxpayer or revenue alike.
Okay, last point. Maybe some of you will be happy to hear. Something that is of particular concern to us, and this is SARS's ability to waive interest. Just a little bit of background here. When you are late in paying your tax, naturally interest is payable. But where you end up needing to pay extra tax because of a dispute or a disagreement, SARS has the ability to waive interest. And they probably won't waive interest if you just didn't pay on time. That's fine. Our concern here is about I spoke earlier on right at the beginning about the complexity of our tax system. So if you genuinely have a different interpretation and you have evidence and you have proof and SARS disagrees with you, and sometime down the line you get to the conclusion that no, the tax is payable, SARS in that case often says, okay, we'll waive the interest, you pay the tax now. We've agreed now that this is what you need to pay, so you pay it. We won't treat it as if you owed it for the past 3 years because there was a genuine dispute. Our concern here is that there's a proposal to withdraw that discretion. It comes, I don't know if this was intentional, but it comes under the guise of saying, you know, there's a separate thing that's being proposed for later this year called the Voluntary Disclosure Program. And under those rules, interest must be waived. It's mandatory. There are rules. There's a 50% rule. There's a 100% rule for penalties and stuff like that. But under those rules, there's no discretion for SARS. The interest simply must be waived, which is fine in the context of those specific rules. But what it then does is it goes far broader than that and says, well, we will remove entirely all SARS's discretion to waive the specific interest in question here, which means even if it has nothing to do with the voluntary disclosure program, just normal taxpayers disputing issues, when if this rule comes in, SARS will no longer have the discretion to waive interest, and we think that is entirely inappropriate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Prof. I'm sure honorable members are itching to ask questions for clarity and so on and so forth, but in terms of our program, the fact that it will take all the presentations and then engage later on. Our experience is that in the past, we would take the first presentation and engage with it, and Prof and his team will always be the first one to have a bite, and the rest of the presenters will have no time left. So in order to be fair to everybody, we'll take the presentations and then thereafter then engage with the discussions and deliberations. Can we then move to South African Institute of Chartered Accountants? I'm not sure who's actually making the presentation.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the Standing Committee on Finance. My name is Munir Hansen. I'm the Project Tax Director at the Institute. Assisting me in the presentation to my left is Vessel Smith. He is a member of SAICA's National Tax Committee. And also to his left is Buleng Maniaka. He is the newly appointed SAICA's Project Manager there. You know, it's at the outset to put in focus our focus areas. We're just going to concentrate on three issues in our presentation itself. But just to alert you to the fact that we've made detailed presentations in our written submissions, and we would also ask the committee members to please pay careful attention to that as well. Because of time constraints, we can't deal with all the issues. I'm going to be dealing with the interest rate narrowing or the limitation thereof. Vettel will look at the company car motor vehicles and fringe benefit implications. And Puleng will take us through to the talk to professional fees and subscription fees and indemnity payments as well, the fringe benefit effects thereon. As far as the narrowing of the interest rate threshold exemption goes, I refer you specifically to the SAICA submission pages 9 to 11 and 2.4 of the explanatory memorandum, if you'd like to call it. The current law, as it stands, the exemption is found in Section 101I, and really what it does is it allows or it gives a resident natural person certain annual exemption thresholds, and for persons under the age of 65, at the moment, it has just been raised in the most recent budget from 21,000 to 22,300. And for persons ages 65 years and older, that has gone now from 30,000 to 32,000. Of the total interest exemption, the first 3,700 last year, for 2010, it was 3,500, of your foreign interest and dividend received is also exempt from taxation. Now, what the proposed change does, and Osman alluded to this as well, is to limit the interest exemption to a specific class or categories of interest-bearing products. And examples here are bank deposits. If you were to, for example, invest in a bank, you will get an exemption. government retail bonds, collective money investment market schemes as well. The specific inclusion list is then added in a new proposed Section 10 capital C of the Income Tax Act. The problem statement that we have is that taxpayers are entitled to certainty and consistency. And I think 2 weeks ago when I attended a presentation, a comment was made that this proposal is almost like bringing down the gates on the taxpayers. Because there are long-term investments that taxpayers have actually undertaken in this regard, and now suddenly as a result of the change in law, they'll have to unwind these long-term investments, which could be a time-consuming exercise. A second point is that the amendment favors certain categories of interest-bearing products, and here specifically, it favors, it affects a free market system, and it also favors the creation of a monopoly. A further point there to note is that each time there's a new product within the market space that comes about, until such time that product is not included in this specific inclusion list, I think taxpayers won't want to go into or invest in that kind of product. It also affects retired individuals who have invested in private projects. Certain individuals have already made long-term plans, as I've mentioned, and for them to unwind from these structures may take 2, 3, even 4 years. In addition, these retired persons is to now basically fund or create funding for the tax liability as a result of this proposed change. It affects legitimate business transactions, and the best is to show you that by way of an example. And it is also a big blow to small businesses, here specifically for startup businesses. If we look at the way it affects a legitimate example, if we have taxpayer A there and taxpayer B, taxpayer A really wants to sell his primary residence to taxpayer B. The purchaser, however, is unable to obtain funding from a bank, say, and assuming these are unconnected persons. As a result, taxpayer A grants a 20-year loan, so similar in terms of market conditions here, that taxpayer B actually negotiated funding with the bank. He uses the house as security. The interest rates are fairly market-related because we are dealing with two unconnected parties. Taxpayer A will now receive interest income from taxpayer B as a result of the loan funding made to him. However, in terms of this current proposal, he will not be entitled to any interest exemption because he's funding into a small business, into a direct person. Had taxpayer A, however, received the cash from taxpayer B, if B actually got the funding from the bank and paid that to A, and A then used that money to fund it into a bank, he would have got the entitlement of the interest exemption. And we find this a bit odd and arbitrary that it affects. This is just one example of a legitimate business transaction that the proposal seeks to target as well. As far as big small businesses, I mentioned it's a big blow for small businesses, particularly startups. And if you look at this example, a startup business generally suffer or generally strive to try and get funding from banks, but because of no trading history, it's quite difficult for them to actually get that funding. So it's common practice within the market space to either go to an unconnected investor to obtain this loan funding. Alternatively, the owner himself may negotiate in his personal capacity with the bank and then on-lend that funds into the business. In both these cases, the interest deduction will be deductible within the business itself, and it will also be included in the other party's side. However, now with the change in the proposal, no exemptions would be available. I'd like to turn specifically to the unconnected party in this case. Assuming the unconnected person has in the region of 278,000 to invest, and his two options now, either to put that money into a bank or alternatively into a business, both yielding an 8% return. That gives him a return of about 22,300, which is equivalent to the annual threshold. If we look at the implications, the return per annum in both cases is 22,300. For the business, he will not, under the current proposal, be entitled to exemption, but under the bank, if he had invested in the bank, he will get an exemption. The tax on that in the business will be 8,920, and in the bank, he'll actually pay no tax on that because of the exemption wiping out the return. And the net effect, I think the bottom line is quite important. If you had the ability of investing into a business versus a bank, here you're only going to yield a return of 4.8% if you put it into a business versus a bank. clearly there's no decision in the matter. You will invest in the bank and not in the small business no longer. So what are our proposed solutions? Really, we're saying that remove the proposed exemption limitation in its entirety, but rather to focus at avoidance schemes which are in the which are identified. And we believe that the current entity avoidance rule within the Income Tax Act is sufficient already to cover this. There are specific sections, like Section 1 to Section 11 of the Income Tax Act, which targets this abuse. If, for example, a father tries to lend or move funds to his minor son, that kind of a situation will be targeted under this, under Section 7273 will actually affect that kind of a scenario as well. In addition, as a top layer, there's also general anti-avoidance rules in terms of Section 80A to 80K that affect or can be used to target this kind of scheme. In the alternative, again, we're saying remove the proposed exemption in its entirety, but then to rather to add specific anti-avoidance legislation, but we would implore you to give us extended consultation period with the proper stakeholders, because this problem was there all the time. It's not a new problem, and if we were to take another year and ponder and come up with a better solution, I can't see the difficulty in postponing this one more year and getting to the right solution that we're proposing. Beto?
Thanks, Nia. Thank you, Chair. Yes, the next point on our agenda is relating to company cars. Now, that's on pages 1 to 5 of our cycle submission, as well as pages 15 to 20 of the explanatory memorandum. If we just stand still for the benefit of the committee for a moment, what we're talking about here is actually company cars. Now, that's why where the employer owns the car, but the employee gets the actual usage of it. Now, there's always been a tax value to it, because, I mean, obviously the employee gets a non-cash benefit and should be taxed on it, but the question is how and at what rate. And that's the important point, and that's where we have the amendment today. Now, in 2005, we had the amendment saying that the percentage per month was increased from 1.8% per month to 2.5%. Now, the current proposal is to increase it to 4% per month, of which 80% of that will be subject to employee tax, meaning that 4% of the determined value, which is basically the cost plus a few items that we're going to look at now, will be subject to employee tax on a monthly basis, irrespective of the actual business use of the vehicle per month. Yes, at year end, you will have to provide a logbook. If there was business use, you will get a reduction. But your monthly cash flow will definitely suffer, and that's what we're going to point out now. Also, if you look at the second bullet there, you will notice that the VAT and the maintenance plan is also now specifically included on this cost on which the 4% is applied to, therefore increasing the value of the fringe benefit. If I move on to the next slide, you will see there that I've just taken a very simplistic example, and obviously, I mean, there's other factors to consider as well, but for the benefit of the committee, if we look at the first bullet there before the amendments, applying the old rate of 2.5% to a 300,000 excluding that vehicle, I haven't considered the maintenance plan in this example. Assuming the taxpayer is at the maximum marginal rate of 40%, the actual tax per month on this benefit will be 3,000 Rand. Now, on the second bullet there, if the proposal is accepted on the table, being the 4% now, which 3.2% subject to actual PAYE, and if that is included at the top, it will result in the monthly tax of 4,378, therefore a 1,378 Rand increase per month, which is quite substantial if you compare percentage-wise and the numbers. Even worse, if at year-end, let's just say it was a pure benefit, it was not somebody who actually used the vehicle as part of his business duties, then the tax would be 4% and the amount will be 5,472, the full 4%, which will basically be 2,400 roughly increase from the old rates. So this is a substantial increase and will definitely have an effect on the employee's cash flow. Now, what I've done in the next few slides, I've broken specific sections into problems with proposed solutions, and I'm going to take you through it. The first bit there is, one of the proposals is that value-added tax should be included in the cost of this vehicle
on which the 4% is applied to, meaning it will actually increase the fringe benefit. Now, in the past, it was excluded. Now, depending on the nature of the vehicle, being a motor vehicle as defined, therefore a passenger vehicle or not a passenger vehicle, some employers might be able to claim that input VAT, some not. Our proposal is here, and it's similar to current VAT legislation for fringe benefits on VAT. Let the legislation have a look at if the employer is entitled to claim that input VAT. If so, the employer is entitled to claim input VAT, then that shouldn't form part of the cost. If the employer is not entitled to claim that input VAT, yes, we agree, then it's a cost to the employer. Very important point is as far as the inclusion of the maintenance plan. As most of you are aware, a lot of new vehicles can be purchased with a 3, 4, or 5-year even maintenance plan in some cases, which is being added to the cost price of the vehicle. Now, the current proposal on the table is take the cost of the vehicle, add its maintenance plan, and take the total amount and apply the 4% or the 3.2% monthly. Therefore, we're increasing the value of the fringe benefit. But compared to the scenario where the employer buys a new motor vehicle without a maintenance plan, still being responsible for the actual maintenance on the vehicle. In such a case, the fringe benefit is only applied to the cost, meaning it's better for the employer to buy a vehicle without a maintenance plan, paying for the maintenance, but on the extra payment of the maintenance, that fringe benefit is not taxed in the hands of the employee. The effect is that there's a difference between an arbitrage advantage and a difference between the two scenarios. So therefore, we are proposing that the maintenance plan, should cost of it should not be included in the cost of the vehicle. Also, we have submitted that the 4% already includes a proportion of it relating to the maintenance. So by adding it to the cost, we're actually doubling it up to a certain extent. That's just a proposal that the maintenance plan, the cost of it should therefore not form part of the cost. A very important problem in this section is so-called distinction between, and that's a practical problem out there and it needs to be solved. Some employees get a company car as part of their remuneration. It's an actual benefit for them. They do not actually use it for business or very limited business use. It's a pure benefit. Compare that to the scenario where an employee actually has the use of a vehicle, but it's mainly for business purpose. Let's take the example of somebody involved in delivery of products. In the day, he used a bucket, for example, there with a small delivery van, and at night time, he takes it home with him, not using it after hours. So there's no exemption for it in the 7th schedule, but the reason that he's taking it home is that first thing the next morning, he has to start with his new deliveries, and he needs to buy a vehicle available, and some companies, even for security reasons, might require the employee to take the vehicle with him. It's safer as the specific employee's home. Now, in a case like that, we refer to it as tool of trade vehicles. The person needs the vehicle for his trade, being provided by his employer. There's no distinction in the current legislation between that and a pure benefit to the employee, meaning that this employee will be taxed monthly on 80% of the 4% fringe benefit rate, meaning we'll have this whole heap of tax that he pays in the year. Yes, agreed that at year end, or upon assessment when he submits his own ITR 12 personal tax return, if he can submit a logbook, which I'm sure he will be in a case like this, that will be substantially reduced. But a person might suffer hardship and will definitely suffer hardship from up to 18 months from the March the first year to until July, August the next year when the actual income tax returns are submitted and be taxed on it. Because monthly they're going to be taxed on this vehicle. Yes, 15 to 18 months later he will submit the tax return and he will claim money back. But why should a person suffer as far as car cash flow goes for that intervening period? So our proposal is that there should be a distinction in the legislation between the so-called benefit vehicles, which is part of your remuneration package, and actual vehicles being used as so-called tool of trade, where you use it for legitimate business purposes, and there should be a mechanism to achieve a fairer result for those individuals. As far as the 4% rate go, I'm not going to take a long time debating it, but if you compare, for example, on a 200,000 Rand vehicle, the AA rates for maintenance, apportionment, fixed cost with a 30% residual value, the actual cost amounts to 7,186, while applying the new proposed rates, it comes to 8,000, so it's not quite in line, and the fringe benefit is therefore higher. And we propose that the 4% be brought in line with this. Actual cost, the cost, therefore the actual benefit that the employee is receiving. If we move on to the employee tax, and I touched on it previously saying that this 4%, 80% of it, meaning 3.2%, will be subject to employee tax on a monthly basis. But in a lot of cases, and it goes back to the tools of trade vehicle, those employees will be using it more than 20% for business. Because assume now it's being taxed 80% per month, so the legislation assumes you use it 80% private, 20% business-wise. But somebody who uses a vehicle extensively for business purposes, let's say somebody driving 40,000 kilometers a year, they might well use it 50,000 of the 40,000 for business purposes, only 10 for private. Now, they will be taxed on a monthly basis again, extensively, coming year-end, and upon assessment, they will be able to submit a tax return and claim back all those taxes. But your cash flow, again, will suffer. So what are we proposing here? Our proposal is that there should be a mechanism in the legislation where either employer, subject to certain conditions, is allowed to reduce the 80%, or if SARS is not happy giving those powers to the employer, they should be able to apply for a so-called hardship directive, and there's other examples where it's allowed in our legislation to apply for a hardship directive in terms of the fourth schedule, similar to that, and a fixed percentage should be agreed upon, and a reduced monthly deduction to achieve a fair result for that specific employee. The last very small point is just by now increasing the so-called cash value of the motor vehicle, and specifically the 80% which is being included in the definition of remuneration in the fourth schedule, the so-called skills development levy and unemployment insurance fund contributions per month is also going to increase, because that's based on this remuneration which is now increased as a result of this proposed amendment. This actually having not really a direct impact on skills and development levy and UIF per nature. So therefore, we are proposing that both travel allowance and fringe benefit be excluded from the actual calculation of the skills development levy and UIF contributions. I'm now going to pass over to Puling, and he will deal with the professional insurance and indemnity.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to the tax fringe benefit for employer and for the employer provided professional fees and indemnity insurance, I would like to refer you to our written submission on page 11 and 12 and section 2.8. The amendment on paragraph 13.2b of the 7th schedule to the Act was amended to clarify the tax treatment of the professional fees and the indemnity insurance paid by employees on behalf of their employees, on the behalf of their employees. So the example that I may give here is fees, subscription fees, which employers pay to their employers pay to on behalf of their professional employers pay to employers. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I can't speak in English. Okay, example of such fees are membership fees paid to professional bodies and insurance indemnity payment in the following professions, such as the chartered accountants, medical doctors, and attorneys. In this regard, the problem that we have... The next slide. The problem that we have is that, okay, paragraph 13.2b of the schedule, of the 7th schedule is not consistent with section 23m of the Act. We are saying that paragraph 13.2b is discriminatory in as far as these fees are concerned. An example of that is I can give the medical doctors who are employed in the government and also the medical doctors who are employed in the private companies. You might find that in most of the cases, medical doctors who are working for the private companies, like in the mining industry and also in the private hospital, the private hospital provide this kind of payment on behalf of them. So in as far as paragraph 13.2b is concerned, It gives that amount of subscription as a fringe benefit, so that in other words, it means that that money is not taxable in the hands of the doctors. But if you take, for example, doctors who are working for the government and are not provided with that tax fringe benefit, they have to pay from their pocket, and when they file in for the tax return at the end of the year, in terms of Section 23M, they are not allowed such tax deduction in their tax return. So we are seeing the introduction of paragraph 2B, we welcome that, but it should be consistent with Section 23M of the Income Tax Act. So that's why we say it is discriminatory. So we propose that, okay, although we welcome the clarification in terms of paragraph 13.2b, we also, however, propose that the relief be extended in terms of Section 23M, that such kind of a subscription fee be allowed as a deduction for the members who do not get such kind of a fringe benefit. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Yeah. We will take the presentation from Deloitte and Touche because the next presenter is running late. We'll join us later. Let's take this last presentation for the first session. Yes, he just arrived. No. You must no. Take your seat. Let's proceed in terms of what I've just said. Yeah, while we're still moving forward, the more I listen to this presentation, something says to me, it is a very complex exercise and business to run government. Because to meet the expectations of ordinary citizens, government has to raise revenue. Now, it is so complex, a business, just to get what is supposed to be there to execute your responsibilities as a state. And I'm wondering and I'm asking myself, what is it that we need to do to simplify things, not for the taxpayer? Simplify things for government to get what is due to it. I think that's one of the things that we must look at as we move forward. Because the presenters are more towards the other side. It's a very complex matter, you know, for government just to get what needs to be there. Not for itself, but for the population. Very complex. Over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On behalf of Deloitte, I'm sophisticated, I think, but I haven't got slides. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I will try and keep it simple. You're quite right that simplicity is one of the canons of taxation. Every first-year taxation student is taught simplicity and certainty. And unfortunately, in a complex world, to achieve a balance between the two is not simple. And therefore, I want to echo the sentiments expressed by some of the other speakers before me to thank National Treasury and SARS for this opportunity to engage in this forum, to put our point of view, if you will, of the taxpayer, of course. We recognize that we won't always see eye to eye. To a degree, I guess, you could say there's an opposition, although there's also a lot of cooperation. But at least if we don't agree, we'd all like to see a system which is logical, makes logical sense, and where the law is applied in an equal manner to all. So it's in that what I intend doing is to do what the speakers from PwC have done, and is to focus on certain issues of policy and not to deal with all the changes. When one reads these two bills that were released, draft bills, it is clear that the process of tax reform in South Africa is far from finished. In this bill, we see, in the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, the first one, we see some very welcome initiatives on the part of Treasury to make our tax system more competitive as a gateway into Africa. We certainly applaud that. We've got some comments where we think it could be made more efficient. But beyond the competitive aspect, there are a myriad of other technical rules where unfortunately one has to read the inside of the bottle top in order to understand it. And the changes are complex. And we might therefore prepare a more detailed submission document. We are busy preparing one, which will be delivered to the two SARs and Treasury and a copy to this forum by the due date, where we will deal with all the issues that we think need to be commented on. So if we follow my our document, I intend following that. I'm not going to deal with all the issues. I also want to, this is also the format as set out in the expansion memorandum that was released with the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. The first point is on the employer-provided motor vehicles, which is obviously something which is always of interest, and you read a lot of that in the press. And the proposal to increase the monthly taxable fringe benefit to 4% of the determined value of the car. Now, we, from a policy point of view, the reason why you've got fringe benefits tax legislation is that you want to make sure that an in-kind benefit is taxed in the same manner as a cash benefit. In other words, whether you pay somebody a salary of 10,000 Rand or whether you give them an asset simplicity of 10,000 Rand, you should pay tax as a taxpayer on the 10,000 Rand. With company cars, if an employee is provided the use of a company motor vehicle, really in our view, the focus should be to say, what does it cost the employer to run this vehicle? This is the employer's vehicle. And you should try and come up with a number that you will tax monthly and then annually, which approximates that cost to the employer. And the degree to which the employee uses the vehicle for private or business purposes, in a sense, is not that relevant in our view. Based on the calculations that we've done, the proposed 4% of the determined value exceeds generally the cost to a company of then running a motor vehicle. And in our view, will not achieve the stated intention that there should be no arbitrage between company cars and travel allowances. In other words, that they should be taxed the same. In our view, based on what we've got here, company cars simply will disappear as a perk then, or an in-kind benefit provided to employees. Now, that may be desirable from Treasury's point of view, I don't know, but we just wish to point out that based on our calculations, we think 4% is excessive. We think 3.2% is probably closer to the mark, and we've done some calculations which we intend submitting with our more detailed submissions document so that Treasury can peruse that and take a view on that. Another issue that we've seen in the press is the desire to merge the payment of lump sum termination benefits with severance packages paid to retrenched workers. We've had reform to our pension fund taxation regime over the past few years. We've got a much more simplified system now in terms of which lump sums from retirement funds, when they're paid, how they are taxed. Last year, in recognition of the tough economic conditions, there was a proposal, which is in fact law, that if a retrenched worker that withdraws money from a retirement fund, as opposed to retiring, or hasn't reached the retirement age, will be put on the same footing, will qualify for the same tax benefits as somebody who has actually retired. What that means simply is that the first 300,000 rand of taxable income of that lump sum is exempt from tax. We've had another provision in our Act for many, many years where if you're retrenched under certain conditions.
Sorry, Chair. Can I just get the clarity from the presenter? What is relating to us, he got it from the paper or he got it from the Act about the lump sum withdrawal? Thank you, Chair.
The lump sum, currently the law states that a retrenched, the person that is retrenched, that then withdraws money from a retirement fund in which he's got retirement funds invested, will be treated for tax purposes the same as somebody that retires. There's a distinction in the tax law between how withdrawals are taxed as opposed to lump sum from retirement. And in essence, a lump sum tax on retirement is taxed more beneficially than a lump sum on withdrawal as a way of encouraging people to save to retirement. But it's recognized that if you get retrenched, you may need to access those funds, and therefore a benefit is bestowed on that person to be able to be taxed under the more beneficial retirement fund lump sum regime as opposed to the withdrawal regime that would normally apply to somebody that hasn't been retrenched wants to withdraw money from a pension fund. That's currently the law in the Act. What is now proposed, there's always been also a provision in our Act that said if one is retrenched and your employer pays out, makes a severance payment to you, that amount, the first 30,000 of that is exempt from tax. We ask it's taxed at your average rate of tax, which is worked out over 2 years. What is proposed now is that this dual system should be integrated in the north, that we should have one system in terms of which somebody that receives a severance package on retrenchment should also be taxed like somebody that's retired or that's withdrawn money or has been retrenched from a retirement fund. So the two systems are now being integrated. That is understandable. It makes it more simple. It simplifies the system. What we'd like to point out, though, again, by doing some scenario, some calculations, is that the new system could actually work against somebody that works, that is now taxed under the new system, and that person could end up paying more tax than what he would have paid under the existing regime in the Act. Again, we'll provide calculations to point that out, and we'd like National Treasury and SARS to consider whether they don't perhaps want to have the dual system continue running. Third issue that we'd like to raise is on the...
I just want, because I'm going through your submission.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Unlike other submissions where they've been summarized.
Yes.
In terms of bullet points and so on and so forth. I just wanted to bring to your notice or to your attention that the time allocated within the 25 minutes that was allocated.
Yes.
So you rather just talk to it than to explain, elaborate.
Okay.
Because you spend almost 3 to 4 minutes explaining one point. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Well, do so, Mr. Chair. No, I speed up towards the end, fortunately. So. Third point is on, which has been mentioned here before, is on the revisions to the executive share schemes and the proposal that dividends be taxed as ordinary revenue. Now, in terms of the existing legislation, the dividend will be taxed as a dividend in respect of an equity share. There's no restriction here on whether that equity share is restricted or unrestricted. Now, generally, the tax point, when shares are granted to an employee, the tax point is when those shares become unrestricted. In other words, when the employee can deal with shares as he deems fit. That makes sense because from that point on, it's not viewed as somebody that holds the shares as an employee, but really holds it as a shareholder. In terms of the proposed definition, it is any dividend in respect of an equity share will be subject to tax as ordinary revenue. That is far too wide because it will also catch unrestricted equity instruments and therefore will also catch shares that an employee holds like any ordinary shareholder. And we therefore propose that the exemption be narrowed or that the taxability of the dividends be narrowed only to restricted equity instruments. turn to 4.1 in terms of our submission statement, the anti-avoidance rule to prevent financial instrument mismatches, a new proposed section 23 capital K. The proposal, as was explained this morning, is that exempt dividend income, which is received by a taxpayer, should be tested against any interest expenditure incurred, and to the extent and should be deducted from any interest expenditure incurred, so that only the net interest expense is potentially taxable. So to explain by way of an example, if a company, as we've got it here, if a company receives incurs interest of 5 million rand, has received 4 million rand of exempt dividend income during the year, and the starting premise is that only 1 million rand of the interest expenditure is deductible. That, in our view, as we've said, constitutes an extraordinary deviation from the well-established principle in our law that a non-trading interest expense that is incurred in the production of income should be allowed as a tax deduction. The test in our law is that one looks to the purpose of an expense and what it actually affects, and if the purpose is productive of income, then a deduction is allowed, and it's a trading and it's a trading expense. What we have instead, in terms of what is proposed under the new section 23K, is a mechanical test where one looks at exempt dividend income on the one hand and interest expenditure on the other hand, and to the extent that you've got exempt income, you've got to deduct that from the interest income without ignoring the substance of or the reasons why the interest expenditure was incurred in the first place. We see this as a retrogressive step, and we strongly object to the introduction of the section on these terms. We understand what Treasury wants to stop. Treasury is unhappy with the fact, specifically mentioned in the expansion memorandum, that banks derive exempt dividend income, that they argue based on an old case, or not so old case, the Standard Bank case, that their borrowings generally are incurred for a purpose productive of income, that all the interest expenditure should be deductible, notwithstanding that they've got some share investments which generate exempt income. We believe, as Treasury has pointed out in the explanatory memorandum, that it's much more sophisticated nowadays in terms of tracking expenditure and what the money is used for, and it is it should be fairly easy, simple to craft legislation if this provision wants to be attained, that links, that makes it a positive test as opposed to a negative test, and that makes it clear that one needs to be able to provide proof that a particular interest expense generated something other than exempt dividend income. We've also pointed out by way of an example that the way that the legislation is drafted at present could mean that an investment that was funded years ago that has since been repaid that continues to generate exempt dividend income, those dividend income would be deducted from normal interest expenditure incurred to fund working capital, giving a completely arbitrary result that bears no rational relation to the actual purpose for the interest expense in the first place. And we therefore strongly, either this needs to be scrapped or this provision needs to be reworked fundamentally in order for it to give effect to the legal principles that we have in our law. I want to deal next with some of the international tax issues, because there's a lot of legislation or changes proposed. It's 5.1 on our submission document, the refinement of the participation exemption. To give some background, any foreign dividend received is in principle subject to tax in South Africa, but there is a participation exemption which is found often around the world in order to encourage residents to bring back dividends from foreign investments if they have a significant shareholding in that foreign investment. In South Africa, that foreign investment is set at 20%. In other words, a South African resident that owns at least 20% of the equity shares or in a foreign company and of the voting rights and that receives dividends from that foreign company will be exempt from, in respect of those dividends received from South African tax. That is clearly, in our view, a very important provision, and it makes us, and it helps making us a competitive holding jurisdiction. Some requirements are now being proposed to that, and we've got an issue with, we've detailed them in our document, but we've got an issue with one or two of them, where we think that Treasury goes too far in trying to stop what it sees as perceived abuses. One, it's clear that it's proposed that any dividends received on preference shares, so not normal equity shares, should not qualify for the exemption. And the thinking presumably is that preference shares, unlike equity shares, really should be treated as debt, as they often are in terms of the accounting rules. And we'd like to point out that often investments are made, preference shares are used for no tax reason, but South African companies that, say, go into Africa where they need to have a local partner, they need to put more funding into this company. They can't put in more equity shares because that will skew the shareholding. They therefore put in preference shares to get the preference share return. So it's got nothing to do with tax, yet that return will now be taxed as ordinary revenue, would now be taxed, whereas really it should be exempt if one follows the thinking behind why dividends on the equity shares are exempt. So if the proposal though is that it should be taxed, and that is how we should go going forward, because it really is debt, then we would say the South African resident making the investment should get a tax deduction on the interest expense, or other interest expenses that it incurred in order to fund the deduction. There's no reason in principle why, if income comes back as taxable, the expenditure incurred to produce that income should not be deductible. And for that reason, we urge Treasury to reconsider the existing Section 11 Capital C of the Act, which prescribes the regime for the deduction of interest in respect of dividend receipts. I think that needs to be revised. But we would say, think carefully about introducing this in the first place. Secondly, it is also proposed that any dividend received by South African, which is linked to an exempt receipt by somebody else, also be taxed in South Africa. And this is the reason for this proposal is to stop cycle fee schemes. Now, the legislation is drafted too widely because, by way of a simple example, as we put in our document, you could have a dividend being declared from one foreign subsidiary to another foreign subsidiary, which is exempt from tax, and then that dividend is paid to South Africa, and now that dividend will be subject to tax in South Africa because it's linked with reference to an amount that was exempt from tax. We propose that if we do want a specific anti-avoidance rule, and I want to echo the comments expressed by Prof. Prology, that one wants to keep these specific anti-avoidance rules to the minimum, but if we do want something like that, we should have the existing provisions in the Act that says if somebody didn't get a deduction in South Africa on an expense incurred here, under those circumstances, the dividend should not be exempt. The Section 10 Capital B is the proposal now, I'm on page 7 of our document, 5.2, restricting cross-border interest exemptions, Section 10 Capital B. The proposal to tax non-residents on interest received from South Africa if it's got certain South African listed vehicles that pay the interest or banks. We note that we understand why there's a need to insert this in the Act so that profits are not extracted pre-tax from South Africa without tax being paid here. We note that this seems to be at variance with the international airport company regime that is being introduced because we bring bringing in legislation specifically for headquarter companies to make us a favorable holding jurisdiction, yet we want to tax non-residents on interest received from making investments into South Africa. At least there should be an exemption for those headquarter companies. We also want to, the existing section also needs to be, in our view, needs to be couched as a withholding tax if it's going to be there, and not just a general tax, in order to make it easier to withhold the tax and pay it over and to reduce the administrative burden of the non-resident. And we think it should be set in at 10% so that it is parity with what we have for SEC and for the dividend tax when that is introduced to replace SEC on dividend distribution. Turning to 5.4, page 8 of our submissions document, the regional holding company regime that is being proposed, something which we really applaud. I think that is truly a step in the right direction to make us more competitive as a holding jurisdiction. In other words, non-residents wanting to invest into Africa, deciding that they'd rather come to South Africa, form a company here, and use South Africa as their base to invest into Africa, than go to, say, Mauritius, some of the other African locations that are marketing themselves as more tax-friendly. The definition that's proposed to be inserted in the Act as to who should qualify as a headquarter company, in our view, the definition is too narrow, though, and we've proposed certain changes to it that we think would make it more workable. We understand that there's a tension here between wanting to encourage South Africa as a holding jurisdiction and protect the South African tax base so that we don't find that these provisions are being abused to undermine the South African tax base. But nevertheless, as we've detailed on pages 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 of our submissions document, these rules would need to be relaxed. For starters, we think that the requirement that the shareholding must be the same for the entire existence of the holding company is too onerous, and then one should test it maybe on an annual basis, and where a headquarter company doesn't qualify and there are reserves that are generated or there are other tax benefits that are being given, that those benefits be turned off for that period that it didn't qualify. We'd like to see South Africa, it being possible to list a company in South Africa as a regional, as a headquarter company. Clearly, if you've got a listed company, you're going to have more than 5 shareholders. But that listed companies also fall within that regime. We believe that the restriction on generating income where 80% of your income and 80% of the investments, where they should be linked to foreign investments, we believe that those restrictions are tight enough in order to curb most of the perceived abuse, and maybe this is a place where one can have a targeted anti-avoidance rule to deal with any tax abuse. And we'd be very happy to engage with the Treasury to help them with proposals around how this could be made more effective as a holding jurisdiction. Finally, on page 12 of our submissions document, 5.5, the Regional Investment Fund Regime. This is also...
I want to stop.
All right.
Just wrap up, please.
Okay. I want to say, in favor of this, we think there's some technical deficiencies in the way that this is being introduced. We've made some proposals to make it more effective, but we absolutely applaud this initiative. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I am going to suggest that we take a break for 10 minutes and we'll come back, because the subject is one. If we enter into discussion for the first 3 submissions, we'll then begin to respond even to the answers, to the proposal that are going to be made by the other presenters. So let's take 10 minutes break, and we take the last 2 presentations when you come back. and then you move on. And then part of sitting arrangements, when you come back, Mr. Mteto will come and sit here next to me. I haven't seen him in a very long time. So thank you very much.
I'm lucky.
Oh, you managed to find out.
Yeah,
you need all the coffee.
Because otherwise, she actually just scans the manual documents and puts the electronic copies onto the website.
Yeah.
But I actually just refer this with what copies.
Yeah. What I normally do, just in case, is I phone Bradley in the morning and just get him to email me everything.
Where are you working from the constituency office? Where is that?
Moscow.
Yeah. So you've got a name. You like it? You like it?
Love it. Yeah,
have you always been with us?
No. And in Parliament also.
So you have to be a member of the IFP?
No.
That's not your political career.
No, I'm an attorney.
And you're doing research?
Sorry? Well, my title is researcher. It's sort of quite broad, what I do for them. So.
Are you an advocate or an attorney? So one day you never went into legal advice?
Yeah, I was parliamentary legal advisor. But you've got to wait for a position to become available. So I wanted to, my path was really to the United Nations, so I need government so I can step into the UN. So I'm just on my feet.
Excellent.
So that's what I'm doing. I can stick whatever I can get.
Have you practiced in court?
Criminal
law and
civil law.
Civil. I've got a lot of friends in criminal law.
Quite lucrative.
Yeah, but they're always busy with bail applications, so they don't have time for anything else.
Those are the ones that people are so desperate they'll find the money to pay. So that's what the criminal law does. They charge per appearance. It's like 500 or 1,000 rand an appearance.
8,000 rand a day for them to appear in court. Or maybe some of them on the cheapest scale, 2,500.
I'm in the wrong thing. Jeez, 8,000 a day.
For one court appearance.
And it's cash.
These are the ones that get represented
naturally. Okay, so I'll start. Mm-hmm. But I think your normal run of the mill attorney.
Okay.
I'm going to go back to the
Concentration strain doesn't have to be that intense, but when they get to the deliberation. So when they get to the actual engagement with the MPs, that is actually the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this can always.
This will pick up from there.
Yeah.
So the questions that are there.
We could have body scores if everyone's wearing body scores.
These are given to us, but you can get them at Sportsman as well.
Okay.
Yeah,
cool.
About $100.
Good luck with the UN.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Of nature that proposal and comment.
Then also a new section 10C is proposed. Now, again, we fully understand why this proposal is tabled and suggested. Now, just to give a brief background on the proposal by Treasury, the interest exemption should only apply to applicable only be applicable to savings that flow into the general economy, and that all other forms of interest are to be taxed at marginal rates. And we appreciate this because we understand that and acknowledge that loans between closely held family companies and other connected persons in the past have created tax planning opportunities and distortions. However, many small and medium-sized organizations are funded by way of loans from individuals who do not necessarily have an interest or maybe have a minority interest. Now, the proposed amendments are unnecessarily punitive towards these individuals and will limit growth in this sector of the economy. Now, our solution here would be that we have a re-look at the interest exemption and expand it to accommodate individuals who provide funds and funding to these small and medium-sized organizations, and provided they do not have an interest or have a minority interest in such organizations. Again, there is opportunities for people to assist these small and medium-sized organizations which do not necessarily want to use it as a tax-paying tool, but rather just to assist the organization to fund itself. And then in addition to that, we recommend that a connected person test could be introduced, or the list of exempt entities could be expanded to accommodate these types of individuals who assist those organizations. Then the proposed amendment to Section 7. Now, this proviso excludes lump sums, and in addition to this, the definition does not include severance benefits. Now, our proposed solution here would be to exclude lump sums, and the lump sum that should not include severance benefits. On the second amendment bill, paragraph 3 of the Saving Schedule to the Income Tax Act. Now, the problem statement here is the fact that we believe that the proposed amendment is wrong and totally unnecessary. Basically, the suggestion here is for Treasury to fall back on the employer to tax apply the tax to the employer and without any set date of whereafter they cannot do this. Now, without going into detail into that, we presume that it was triggered by the Vacation Club case, and we believe that in this context it was misplaced. Now, the premise of the Income Tax Act in the context of fringe benefits is that the recipient, the employee who receives this fringe benefit, is the person who must bear the tax benefit, must bear the tax on the benefit. And this in this particular case, it was never at dispute, and this was even confirmed by the court. Now, our solution to address this anomaly would be to look at the current legislation and to acknowledge that it already contains sufficient provisions to allow SARS to effectively administer employees' tax. In this instance, we can refer to paragraph 7 of the 4th schedule and existing paragraph 3 of the 7th schedule. What is needed here is that employers and employees alike must be given easier access to SARS to enable them to agree on the value of the benefits in dispute, and the Act must not be amended. Thank you.
Short and sweet. But obviously we take the point that you raised at the beginning, that the timing or the time allocation for your preparations was, that goes for everybody who has made the presentation. And I will make a comment at the end of this deliberations on that matter, part of the process. Can we take the last presentation? Are you here? James? Okay. No, you'll be surprised.
Chair. I'll try and keep this as short and sweet as possible also. Bye. Okay. We have also tried just to focus, given the time frame, on certain matters of policy. These follow the ordering in the explanatory memorandum that you had from SARS and Treasury previously, so it's not necessarily in the order of importance. And I'll just go through the four main headings that we've identified above. First, with regard to the employee share schemes, what the bill proposes to do is tax dividends, which you've heard about already. Just to echo the point made by Deloitte that the taxation should be restricted only to those restricted equity instruments covered by 8C. It shouldn't serve to tax dividends that if you go out and buy a share on the GSE, then it shouldn't apply to those. The other point that we'd like to make is, I think PwC also made the point, was that in this instance it's only equitable that if we're going to tax the dividend, that the company should be given a deduction for the payment. If it's viewed as salary on one side, it should be viewed as salary on the other. We would go one step further, that the legislation as it stands also taxes currently if you receive a capital distribution from a company while it's a restricted equity share, then that is subject to tax, and we would say that the same principle should apply here for the dividends. It's worth pointing out that under the existing general anti-avoidance scheme mechanism in the Act, SARS is obliged to apply consistency between parties. So if SARS makes an adjustment to one party, it's obliged to make a balancing adjustment to the other. And that's the principle that we're looking for to apply here. I would just say that if that is the principle in avoidance schemes, the vast majority of share schemes aren't avoidance schemes, so it would be unfair to treat them more harshly than an avoidance mechanism. From the SDC, that was just a small point that the memorandum said that SDC will not be levied, but it's not yet in the bill. And then it may sound odd coming from a previous chair said from the taxpayer side, but it doesn't appear that the dividends would be subject to PAYE just now. So what we're actually suggesting is that at the time the dividend is declared, if it is subject to tax, the company should be obliged to withhold PAYE to avoid a nasty shock for taxpayers later in the year. And again, the same principle should apply to the distributions. One point as regards what PAYE is currently levied on is that if you make a gain on an equity instrument under 8C, that is included in your PAYE calculation and the company will be obliged to withhold PAYE. Under the current legislation, that's a one-sided game, and that if you make a loss, the company is not permitted to take account of that loss and apply a reduced PAYE withholding, and we would suggest that for equity that should be included. Finally, on the employee share schemes, there are a number of instances where double tax can arise, and we would just suggest that this be included in the bill at the same time as we are applying these revenue generating methods. We should look to alleviate the instances where double tax arise. I've included a couple of those points in the written submissions that went to the committee. They're not on the slide here because they tend to get quite technical in nature. The second point is on the limitation of interest deduction, which is the proposed section 23K you've heard about previously. Again, some of the points I'm making are just going to reiterate the points made previously. The explanatory memorandum says that this is something targeted at misuse by financial institutions of the Standard Bank case that you've heard about. The issue here, from our perspective, is that whilst applying this in light of that, it actually applies to all taxpayers, not just to the modern financial institutions. And whilst the modern institutions have got tracing mechanisms that will allow them to effectively make sure that this doesn't bite them, the smaller taxpayer certainly does not. I would also say that if this is retained, in its current form it's unduly harsh. The explanatory memorandum uses the example, if I have total income of 15 million, 10 million is taxable interest and 5 million of exempt dividends, and I've got total expenses of 6 million, then they will deny a deduction for $5 million, not on a pro rata basis, just on a straight, whatever my exempt income is, we'll deny a matching deduction. That, for us, ignores commercial reality. It suggests that my exempt income is not profitable and my taxable income is excessively profitable. We would also highlight that as it currently stands, there are no provision made for extraordinary events such as unbundlings or group reorganisations, which may actually generate exempt income or income not subject to tax. Provision should be made to scope those out of the application. And I think we heard from Deloitte previously, there was the issue as regards assets acquired some time ago. Where those assets are not acquired from non-deductible sources, this will apply on an arbitrary basis. And the other issue maybe worth pointing out here is that if we acquired assets 10 years ago, 15 years ago, from a SARS perspective, the obligation in the legislation is that I only need to keep my records for a limited period of time. Introducing the section as it stands just now is going to penalise me if I haven't kept my records despite the legislation saying I don't need to. And finally on this one, Deloitte said that this is a conflict with the purpose test as we currently have it in law, and I would agree with that. If it is to stand, we will need clarity as to how it interacts with the purpose test. For example, we say in the previous example that I had $6 million of expense. If we move to a pro rata basis, for argument's sake, and we say $2 million is denied, I'm now left with $4 million. The question arises, well, which $4 million of my interest expense is left? Is it the good interest or is it the bad interest? And that there's an interaction there that will need to be provided for in the legislation. On the international aspect, we've 2 points here that we'd like to cover. The first being the restriction of cross-border interest exemption proposed Section 10 Cap B. And I have to say, in the current environment, we have to question whether this is advisable just now. We've heard that we're looking to attract international investment, yet here we have something that is going to impact on South Africa's desirability as an investment destination. We'll go through two examples. The first is, if we have a multinational group with investments in South Africa, these are groups that typically have investments globally, and they will select where they want to apply their investment by where it's going to generate them the best after-tax return. So to impose an additional tax here may restrict that. Secondly, with foreign banks lending to South African corporates, in fact, whilst I put here that this one is subject to Reserve Bank approval, the lending by multinational parents to the subsidiaries is also subject to Reserve Bank approval for inward loans. And what Reserve Bank approval does is it stipulates what interest rate may be charged and what the repayment profile may be. But more particularly with foreign banks, those agreements typically will contain gross-up clauses or early redemption clauses. And what those provide for is if there is a change in law, such as proposed here, that the interest rate, for example, would be changed from 10% to 11%, so that the foreign lender would be in the same post-tax position as he was previously. Now, the two issues in the context of those foreign loans are, one, if we have a gross-up in a loan rate, then it may actually take you outside of the Reserve Bank permitted rates. Typically, the Reserve Bank allow you a rate that is 200 basis points over the repo rate or the prime rate at the time. So if we put in this legislation and a gross-up clause triggers, you technically have a loan that may be in breach of the gross-up clause. In breach of the Reserve Bank parameter. The implication of that is that then you fall into the early redemption clause, where the foreign lender is entitled to then call for early repayment of the loan. In the current market, we see that as being particularly problematic because, one, whether the company has the access to own cash to repay the loan if it's triggered, and two, whether if they don't have the own cash, whether in the current market they can actually go out and find the refinancing available to repay the loan. And the other point we'd make is it would appear to be totally at odds If we're looking at introducing a favourable headquarters company regime, you've got something here that's going entirely the opposite direction, which is prejudicing South Africa as an investment destination. The removal is a small technical point that there's a current exemption that hasn't been removed in putting this new restricted one in. The other international aspect, just to touch on quickly, is the thin capitalisation of branches, which in one respect is what we're looking to do is apply the same principles to branches of foreign companies as we apply to domestic companies. However, again, we would say that provision is cast too widely. Unlike the provisions that apply to companies, there is a connected person requirement, or there's a similar participation in the profit requirement, which it doesn't exist in the proposed change. And we just question whether cognizance has been taken of South Africa's double tax treaties, in that in certain of the treaties there is a non-discrimination clause which specifically precludes South Africa from levying less favourable tax on branches than is on similar activities conducted by local entities. We just flag that one just now. It seems, particularly given, if you remember, some years ago there was a non-discrimination issue which the Minister specifically addressed by a change in legislation. We just want to make sure that the cognizance has been taken here. Failing that, I think the one point we would make here is that, as we understand it, the bill is scheduled to be introduced to, or tabled in Parliament in its final form in the middle of August. The proposed effective date for this change in legislation is 1 October of this year. If this is to come in, what we would say is that we need to look at an extended implementation date simply to allow companies a more meaningful time to change their structure to come within the parameters rather than giving them only a six-week period. We have got a number of companies that will look at doing that, but they don't want to do it pending the final legislation. Two other points just to touch on. There's a change to the dividend definition proposed, which is actually aimed at being taxpayer friendly. What it does is says if a company goes out, a listed company goes out and buys its own shares back on the JSE, then it's not going to be a dividend by the company. Under the existing definition, if you buy back your own shares, it's classified as a dividend. The proposal is to take that away. If you buy it back and it is a dividend, the company pays STC and the recipient then receives a tax-exempt dividend. The issue always was, because the seller didn't know that the company was the purchaser, he didn't know what he got with an exempt receipt. So he was paying CGT, or rent income tax, on the transaction, and the company was paying STC. So this change is actually aimed at taking away that double taxation, which is great. The issue is it goes far wider, and it applies to all transactions or all buybacks by a listed company, even where the parties are aware of who each other are. So we just suggest a need to carve out that it's only those transactions where the party is unaware. Excuse me. The other issue with this one that we have, which is the bigger issue, is that it's intended to have retrospective effect. You'll see I've put up on the board. It's intended to kick in from the start of years of assessment, ending on or after 1 January 2010. So here we have a law that's going to come in August or October this year and will apply for a company with a March year end. It will already apply from 1 April last year. Okay. Now, there the issue is, if a company, let's use that example of a March year end, a company in June last year bought its shares back. In July, it would have paid STC. February this year, the selling party would have done its tax calc and pay CGT or income tax, and now we're reclassifying that now. So if this is to come in this form, we would just suggest that it needs to be prospective rather than retrospective. And then, my apologies, Chair, I'm going to sneak a little final one in here, but it is the last one, that isn't in the bill. It was an anomaly that came to our attention recently. Which is as regards the ability of individuals, natural persons, to offset foreign losses. bearing in mind that South Africa now taxes worldwide income and has done for 10 years, the ability to offset foreign trading losses is limited to foreign trading profits from other foreign trades. So what you're not able to do is offset a foreign trading loss against, for example, foreign trading income or foreign capital gain. And that, to our mind, is totally at odds to policy or what is equitable in tax. When the limitation was introduced, it was done so on two bases. One was the fact that insufficient information was held by SARS at that time, obviously because prior to the introduction of worldwide tax, SARS didn't know about offshore losses. So that was a valid point then. We're now 10 years on from when that has come, with people filing returns on a worldwide basis. So I would like to think that SARS would have that information available now. And then the second point would be there was a specific anti-avoidance concern raised at the time about people having foreign losses in a branch and then incorporating into a company so that the foreign losses would never effectively be recaptured. And I think in that instance, whilst I agree with the prior commentators as to the preference to using the GAR that we spent so long in putting into legislation, if this really is a concern, then it's one thing that a number of other jurisdictions globally have actually introduced a very easy specific anti-avoidance provision on. And Chair, thank you. Also a short and sweet.
Thank you. As I said, this was the last presentation. Obviously, the first two or three presentations we had the summarized version of those presentations in terms of highlighting key points. One or two would not have those kind of things. And I hear you to be saying that you are going to make your submission is here. Is the submission around? Not yet.
You have the.
You send it.
We have the full
version. The full, yeah, the full submission.
Sorry, the
yeah.
PowerPoint presentation that you
yeah.
saw just now will be.
Okay.
Bradley has it by email now.
Okay, good. What I'm going to suggest is that we are not going to follow the discussions in a particular pattern in a particular order. As I said earlier on, that the subject matter is one. And all the presentation was not based on sectoral interest. It was generic. So questions should then be posed and discussions should be general to assist the process as it unfolds. Because at the end of the day, we need to make sure that National Treasury takes into consideration as many inputs as it can to arrive at the final product that will come before the committee before Parliament can finalize and ratify, you know, the proposal from National Treasury. Honourable members, are we okay in that or with that approach? The other thing that I really want to commend you on is that all of you got invited within a very short space of time, and want to thank you for your response. I know you all have 24 hours a day, so there's no excuse. It depends on how you use those hours. But some of us, 24 hours means many things within those 24 hours, especially if you're in this honorable house here. Clearly, your presentation helps also the committee, because it's not the beginning or the end. It's the beginning of a process, even for the committee itself. So this presentation makes it easier for us, much easier, to actually interact with the text proposals that come from the National Treasury, so that as they come back to respond to us, we'll also be having a proper distinct proposal from yourself on how you think we should look into this matter of Parliament and therefore National Treasury at the end of the day. So I'll allow honourable members to interact with the presentation as presented to us. didn't record your apology much earlier, Doctor, but it was received, and also Dr. Ambrose. No. Doctor?
No,
yes, I'm right. I thought it was by inference because you're sitting next to
me.
All right, we also received your apology and thanks for landing and coming to work. That's a sign of a dedicated, honorable member to the public and the duty that the public expects us from ourselves. So we are here. The time is 6. Good enough. Okay. Dr. George, followed by my friend here, Ambrosini. Honorable Goranov, Madamini, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I'm very pleased to receive my apology. I do apologize for being late. On the presentation by SICA, they made various proposals or proposed solutions, but I'm not sure that it's entirely clear on the how. For example, on page number 16, when we're talking about the maintenance plan should be excluded from the determined value, the maintenance plan, my understanding, is actually factored into the value of the item. So would it be a deemed amount or, you know, exactly what was going through the mind? Because obviously if Treasury is going to properly consider the proposals that are put, they need to also be able to implement them. On the PricewaterhouseCoopers, I never saw the presentation, but I did read the document. And Chairperson, they raise a very important point regarding the consultation period and also the money bills. We did speak about it last week, regarding the process. Now, we did, earlier on this year, we did approve the revenue proposals that informed the fiscal framework. So therefore, in theory, if changes are going to be made to the legislation, it would then impact on the fiscal framework, which would then obviously require us to consider the overall impact. So if there are going to be any proposed changes, we actually need to know what the impact is going to be on the fiscal framework. So it's going to need to have some kind of a number attached to it, unless I'm just missing the point, but I think that is something we need to consider. And then, Chairperson, you mentioned the issue about the complexity of the tax laws, and I think it's a very good opportunity for me to just jump in there and add to what you said, Chair, is that we have raised before in this committee and in the previous Parliament about the fact that our tax laws are getting exceptionally complicated and complex, and that we do need to look into simplification in some way. And perhaps it now is the time for us as a committee to consider something like a tax commission or a something where we can start putting our mind onto this thing. And then finally, this is really for the Treasury, is that I remember that there was some kind of incentive for the film industry that we were talking about at some point, but I haven't seen anything about it, so I'm just wondering if it's still around. Thanks, Jeffers.
Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to comply with your ruling to try to be general in the comments, even though one would have many specific details. So I'm going to make three general points, if I may. The first one, in reaction to what you said, Mr. Chairman, that in our engagement we are to convince Treasury of the wisdom of what is being told to us. And again, I mean, I must restate my confusion because and I go by the letter of the law and the letter of the Constitution, and I live under this terrible misapprehension that we are actually writing laws here. And I'm constantly confronted with the reality that we are just begging the departments to make some amendments on their laws, which we are required to approve. And I would wish this committee to be a little more proactive in taking the courage of taking a pen and rewriting what we don't like. I mean, we are the representative of the people. If we can't write laws, we shouldn't be here. That's the first point. The second point is that we are in a very critical juncture. The issues which have been raised, and I read some of the submissions, the echoing theme is one of fairness. We need to take cognizance that the state is desperate. And in being desperate, it's trying to find money wherever it can. And in so doing, it will do, as Mr. Hengel put it, close the loopholes, but at times will squeeze people. And I think that we as a committee, we the representative of the people, should be particularly aware of that. And when people here talk about fairness and equitable approaches, our ears should go up and say, hey, this is something where we need to say no. The third point, and again, trying to be general, but I want to go into just one little measure of detail. This entire situation with the Reserve Bank approval for foreign loans. And I had a number of dealings with them. It's an entire rotten situation where it does work to a certain extent in a parent subsidiary situation with all the documents before them and a clear situation, but it doesn't work in the reality of economics where you find money where you can. The field where it's absolutely a catastrophe is in venture capital. Effectively, no one in South Africa can resort to foreign loans on a venture capital basis because the Reserve Bank, they have no understanding how the venture capital market works. They look at the venture capital operation and says, well, you should have a 10% interest rate because it's the cost of money. Venture capital operates on different basis. And this is enormously detrimental to our country in isolating the business opportunities within South Africa from the international venture capital market, which creates businesses and opportunities where on a commercial basis is not possible. If I can just make one itsy-bitsy point of detail, just because on this entire issue of the payment of membership fees, I mean, the basic concept is that whatever is instrumental to the creation of your income should be deductible. The your being whom you are professional, even though you do not practice the profession, it is part of what over a period of time requires you to produce that income. Let me give you a simple example. I'm a member of the New York Bar and the DC Bar. I'm not practicing, but if I were employed, even if I not practice, I still need to pay those membership fees because then when I start practicing again, they won't let me off the hook, and everything needs to be paid in between. So I don't pay now, I need to pay later, which means that my next employer will need to pick up the bill for the entire my past dues, or I myself need to carry the bill for the entire tax period where I'm not using it without the possibility of deducting those expenses from when then I begin repracticing law, whatever the membership is. I've spoken more than you would allow me to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairperson, thank you very much.
Take a few minutes that he left.
Yes, I will be short as usual. Can I just start with the last point? I do not understand why SARS wants to tax professional people, you know, not allow them to subtract that from tax. I do not understand the logic to that. Maybe they will explain that later to us. Then on the company car issue, I fully concur. I think it was SAICA, what they were saying, and many others, fully concur in what they're saying. I'm just getting the unnecessary feeling that SARS is targeting the motor car industry. I don't know. It's a very successful industry in South Africa. It is growing. But I don't get the idea why we're going so full blast in terms of company car fringe benefits. Lastly, I don't like share options. I think it's a quick, rich scheme misused in South Africa by many, many CEOs and such a certain level. So I don't care whether they tax dividends and there's double taxation. What I want to ask from the presenters, is it still so fashionable in South Africa, or is it going out? What is happening to share options? We've just had this report by Philip Tiernison on where conducted a study on 326 JSE listed companies. And you know, clearly people do get shares. They don't pay for it. Make no mistake. They pay for it in a certain sense, but they don't pay for it. But then they get all the profits, and it's only capital gains tax on that. So, you know, share option, I think we need a debate on that issue in South Africa.
Nazami?
Thank you, Chair. Maybe one needs to start by really appreciating from all the presenters that we are aware of the time frames and the short space that were given to you, but indeed we are appreciating that you were able to come and do the presentation. And also to appreciate that within your, I would say, unsatisfactory or uncomfortable, you will also be able to come up with some of the proposals. This doesn't mean that eventually at the end of the day, then it's not very much that they have to, but at least you know how you think and you know how you understand the whole concept. Honorable Chair, I just need some few clarity to Mr. Hassan and Mr. Smith. When you're looking at your narrowing the interest threshold exemption within your problem statement, you highlighted that the taxpayers are entitled to consistency, Mr. Treasury's confidence, sanctity in application of laws, regulation, policies, procedures pertaining to making of long-term investment decisions, and estate planning. Now my question is, for you to arrive to such a big statement, is there a perception or somewhere where the National Treasury actually violated this consistency, this sanctity and confidence? If so, exactly where? Because this is what they are saying. And then the other one, you said amendment favors certain categories of interest bearing products and institutions, thereby interfering with the free market system and creation of monopolies in financial sector. I don't know. I'm sitting on this chair and I'm asking myself, in which system, as far as free marketing in South Africa, do we see this being practiced? Because at the back of my mind, I think we are a mixed economy. And the argument is based on what? If you can get the clarification on that. So excuse me, because I've got quite a few of them which are not clear. And then you also proposed the amendment will have negative impact. Oh, now this one, I'm sure it goes to what? PwC. Negative impact on small business access to funds. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Because the latest presentation was actually telling us that the amendment needs to be expanded so as to accommodate individuals who support small and medium-sized companies, but bearing in mind that those individuals do not have interest or another thing. That's what the latest said. Now, and then on the other side, you're getting the people who are saying negative impact on small business. Now, what is this negative impact? We understand the side that we need to accommodate, but how do you monitor that? That this individual, how the department, the business president is going to monitor that? That these individuals really do not have an interest. The last one, the ability, the last presentation is still on his chair. He said ability to offset foreign losses. Can you clarify to me that what is the meaning to the ability to offset foreign trading losses limited to other foreign trading profits? What is the meaning to that? And the last
request, Chair, from your side is to maybe to request our National Treasury, because they're all here, because out of what was presented by almost all the presenters, you'll find that the department has worked on it, like the lump sum withdrawal, like I don't know which clause was this, but it speaks on the ensuring that the receipts, maybe the National Treasury will remember that and speak on that, so that the presenters, they are aware that the department is doing something about it and they have actually improved on that. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Tetua, followed by Luyenge, and then we'll allow the presenters to respond. Oh, Van Roy, you'll be the last.
Thanks, Chair. I want three clarities. The first one it's around the employee share scheme. I just wanted to know, it has been said, if my collections were correct, that if employees got shares with the company, the only part that gets taxed is the part of the employee. I want to get some clarity on that as to when the company get also been taxed on this matter. The second one, Chair, is the concern from the, is it Waters and Coopers, where it's the where they are concerned is that, because I think now for some time for workers who get retrenched, they have been almost the 30,000, if I'm not mistaken, 30,000 untaxed benefit. But if what is their concern if it's moved to the higher bracket of the 300,000? Where is the concern? Because most of the people that you find under those categories are very people on the very, very poor level. So therefore, if he gets 50,000, it's only 30,000 that gets taxed, and then he's left with 20. That person get out of with the package of nothing. I don't know what is their package. What is the problem around there? If I may be clarify that concern. The last one, Chen, is around company car scheme. Is the writer here also aware that there are employees that are using cars which they keep, maybe they use also for their personal benefit after hours, but those car, they are not given car allowance. They don't. The only thing is just to drive those car to do organizational or company works. Where do you classify those workers in terms of this tax, because they don't even get even the 4% or any car allowance, but they keep that car, they use it as their tool, irrespective of the value of the car. They don't have a decision maker as to what car to drive tomorrow or the next day, but they simply drive those car. It's often found in organization that there are people who are doing that, but cars, they only maybe they become underwriters, that's all. But they don't get anything out of that. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Mine, Chair, is on the issue that relates to consistency, which has been alluded to by one of the presenters. I mean, I think the Treasury will maybe come to my rescue, because what one understands, if an amendment is presented, it seeks to address something. So if there are inconsistencies that have been referred to, and the inconsistencies that exist in SARS, because there is a lot of inconsistencies in the manner in which SARS execute its duty. This year you will get a refund, next year you are told you are owing 120. Once you cry foul, you say, no, it's 49. once you say, I'm taking this matter up again, no, it's around 19. So you don't know as to how does these things get to where they are amended or else sustained as they are. I mean, I don't want to say the statement that has been that was actually made by Deloitte here to say this 4% seemingly is not to any advantage because it is more than an allowance for a car that has been provided to an employee, or whether one is not very sure whether this amendment is feasible enough or reliable to accommodate the poorest of the poor, because if small businesses are not going to benefit out of this amendment, whereas the majority of our people are poor and have been emerging since 1994. I don't know when will they come up. They've been emerging. So if amendments of this nature are not going to assist, one remains with a lot of questions. Then lastly, Chair, is the issue of car allowance and the tool of trade. I don't know whether the insertion here that was saying if you are owning, if you have been provided with a car by your employer versus using your own car and came for whatever distance that you are traveling, it's tantamount to what would you suggest? Is it advantageous for one to use this car allowance or rather use your own and claim? So we need advice because these amendments, as the chairperson has alluded, they are very complex. We may not understand, but we are taking advantage of having these sessions with you because we don't know when to influence you to take a particular decision, or else we are just informed that there's this coming. Whatever you can say or do, it's not going to change. It's a form of a formality that we must go past you. But we are representing the public. We are not very sure as to how do these complex issues will translate into the real solution of the problems on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me start by welcoming the presentation. Chair, I think it emerged quite unambiguously from all presenters, this issue of the interest exemption that is, according to them, going to discourage obviously, or that is going to have negative impact on the small businesses. Now, what I missed in the submissions is how presenters are envisaging this whole exemption rating to be structured when it comes to natural persons, because currently we are very clear on the proposed structuring of the rating in terms of the banks, but we are not sure of what is it that they're suggesting. Are they suggesting that the rates must be the same, or maybe the rates must be a bit biased, I mean, to natural persons? And secondly, Chair, notwithstanding, I mean, the complicated nature of our tax laws, I think to me it's very important because we're in the process of effecting some amendment bills to our tax law regime. I think to me it's very important to get to know if from our practitioners, if there are other areas that they think might have been overlooked as a way of enhancing this particular process. If there are any areas that they think, obviously, the current bills are not paying attention to, and that might have a negative impact to our taxation system. And thirdly, Chair, there's one presenter who, I just forget who was that one, who made a mention of the fact that if October is the implementation date, there will be a need for companies, I think it's changed, there will be a need for companies, to be given more time. But this, James was not specific, what was he referring to by more time? Because I think for us, to conclude on this matter, it will be important to get that sound advice. What will be more time after, the implementation date of October? Thank you.
As a way of maybe guiding how we respond to these issues and questions of clarity, there are two sets of approaches here. One is committee to treasury. Committee has received the presentation from various institutions today in terms of tax proposals. We need to get more clarity on your presentations in terms of questions that have been raised. That's the first part that I thought we should try to delineate from other processes. The second set of issues is that most of the issues that you have raised with us, we are noting as the committee for further processing with National Treasury as a committee in-house. The third leg is that from here, the issue that you have raised with us as a committee and have noted, you still have got another opportunity to interact with National Treasury to iron out and also have an understanding from where they come from. And when that process is complete, National Treasury will come back to us as a committee, with all these issues that you have raised with us. And the committee will then still piece these issues or treat them to a point where we'll feel satisfied as a committee that this is the direction that we want you to do, to answer the question that Honorable Ambrosin was raising earlier on, to say, are these imminent persons, proposals, complete and cannot be amended. The power lies with Parliament. I think I must make that very clear. We shouldn't question ourselves whether we've got the power to do this or not. But I thought I should just make sure that we understand the three areas of engagement. And therefore, I would prefer that the responses should actually even come from the presenters today, in terms of clarifying the questions that have been raised by honorable members. If there's one or two issues National Treasury would want to speak to, we'll allow you to do that, but we'll not exhaust your portion today. Your part is still coming with us to deal with those issues. So I think the process should be very, very clear to all of us by now. You seem to be itching to say something. Yeah. Of course, I did indicate on the issue of time by 20 past 12, we should be done with this interaction. I don't want to behave like those people who believe that they can stop the watch to save time. Unfortunately, you can't stop the watch to save time. We'll have to work within the time allocated. Who's going to lead? Prof, and bear in mind that there are others who want to have a bite. Okay.
Thank you, Jay. I think there were quite a few issues raised. Perhaps not all of them are relevant to me, although I suppose there will also be some overlapping as well. I just want to deal with two things, really. The one thing was on the interest exemption for around consistency of investment decisions. What are we talking about? What do we mean? Where's the problem? And also, what do we mean when we say negative impact on investors? And if I can perhaps just use a quick example to illustrate the point. What do I mean by negative impact on the one hand and consistency on the other hand? An example I want to use is, let's say I need money. I want to start a small business. I want to start a spaza shop. And Bradley over there has got 250 or 300,000 rand to invest. I need the money. He's the lender. Yeah. On the question of consistency, the issue here is Bradley's got 250,000 rand in his hand, and his question is, should he lend it to me or should he deposit it in the bank? At the moment, there is consistency because the tax treatment will be identical. But the message that this proposal gives is no, rather give it to the bank. So that is what we mean by there's a consistency of investment decision from the lender's perspective. As far as the negative impact is concerned, that's the impact is on me. Because now the people who would ordinarily have funded me, they are saying to me, it's a bad idea to give money to you, because if we put it in short-term changeable investments, things, you know, that come and go, like listed debentures or bonds, that's what Treasury is encouraging. But long-term fixed investment into small businesses like you, that's not what's being encouraged. That's a bad idea. So that's what we mean by when we say negative impact and lack of consistency. On the second question that I wanted to respond to was two questions related to share schemes. One was, how fashionable are they? I do think from a tax perspective, they've certainly become less fashionable. I think we've had some intelligent drafting from SARS and the new Section 80 to specifically address the kind of thing that Mr. Kuranov was referring to. And so it's still an economic reality, it's still relatively fashionable as a normal economic remuneration mechanism, but I don't think it's the tax planning tool that it used to be, and I think some, as I said, good drafting it. The second question we had relating to shared schemes is, what do we mean when we said double taxation, and what's the problem with the proposal? And again, if I can use an example, let me just compare it to the payment of a salary. If I run a business and I, for my normal trading activities, earn 1,000 rand, if I give that 1,000 rand to you as an employee, that 1,000 rand is not going to be taxed in my hands, it's going to be taxed in your hands, because I received the 1,000 rand, but I gave it up. Yes, so I'm not being taxed on the 1,000 rand, you are. What the dividend proposal does is that it says, I will receive 1,000 rand if I on-pay that 1,000 rand to you as a dividend, both of us are being taxed on 1,000 rand each. So that's the double taxation point that we were referring to there. I think some of the others will just deal with some of the other points.
Thanks, Bob. If nothing else, now I continue, chat.
Okay.
Yeah, is that okay? And then we'll pass on. So you've dealt with the PwC bit. The only comment I wanted to say was that the comment that the interest provisions seem to overlap through most of the presentations, and that's where the comment made as to whether you have the right to change or to ask them to think about it a bit more. I would say that you do need to look at that provision very carefully and consider whether it is an issue that needs to have more thought. For these reasons, because they are at policy level, they appear to be suggesting portfolio investment at a time when we want business to grow, at a time when we've just gone through a recession and hopefully are coming out of it. We are saying to people, do not lend or be taxed differently if you lend into a business. The provision on the interest we dealt with then was the local interest, with natural people receiving the interest. The other denial was for foreign lenders, which is good from a perspective that we are essentially saying to people, come through treaties. But the way the legislation is currently worded is so administratively problematic for non-residents, it's unmanageable, and therefore is one of those where we put our hands up and say, this is bad law. Think about withholding tax, think about deferring it if possible to get it right. As it's currently worded, it can't be implemented, and that's why we're concerned. And then the last thing on the three steps, Chair, we've always said that we're very happy with the process and the way it's gone, and it happens because of the interaction of the parties, in that there is this common
goal to try and get it right. But if one looks at the process, at the end of the day, the instrument of communication is always National Treasury. And a number of times over the years, when that final step is made and it comes back and this is what we accept and this is what we don't accept, there is never an opportunity for the taxpayer or the public to say, you know, we believe National Treasury misunderstood this. And I think that that really at some point, if it's at all possible, that there is, such as today, a morning where it is heard, and if there is something that is so glaringly wrong, we're talking at 80-20 rule, someone can at least put their hand up to the committee and say, I think they've misunderstood this, or I think what's being done wrong. And then, of course, it's up to the committee to make their decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. From Psyca side, I deal with the motor fringe benefit questions first, and then you will deal with the interest side of it. There was quite a few questions, and some of the other presenters are welcome also to add their bits. But if I start on the one regarding the maintenance plan, which has been raised by the doctor here in front, just to compare the current practice, currently SARS do allow you to remove the motor vehicle maintenance plan. Although it's embedded, I agree with you totally, into the price, if you go to the motor dealer, they do have it cost separately on the system. So what we're in practice currently doing, it's being taken out, and the current 2.5% fringe benefit is calculated on the cost of the motor vehicle, excluding the maintenance plan. And that's, we propose that process continues. Although the cost price might state it out to the consumer as one price, you can actually cost it separately. Then there was a statement by Mr. Kurnhoff at the back regarding the motor industry, and I mean, from Psyca side, we fully concur, just to emphasize the point, at the 4% rate, somebody purely a benefit, not adding any business use, the person at 4% will, within 25 months, be taxed on the whole cost of the vehicle, meaning that if you get a 300,000 vehicle, in 25 months, you'll be taxed on the whole 300,000. The question there is, was the usage of that vehicle for 25 months worth 300,000? That is the question to be asked, and that's what we have to get right, the balance there. As far as the other comments made, there was a comment regarding the travel allowance versus the company car. Now, the idea is, I think, for there not to be any arbitrage. I think the idea is that the one should be more beneficial than the other one. I mean, the tax rules should be fair and equitable to both. We should not be killing the company car today, nor should we advocate the travel allowance. That's school of thought there, and that's what we're trying to achieve. I mean, from the travel allowance side, just for the benefit of the committee, where you get a travel allowance from your employer, but you use your own motor vehicle for business purposes. At the end of the year, you maintain your logbook, and you claim a deduction against it. That's the one option. The other option is you don't own the motor vehicle. Your employer gives you your company car, and yes, you use it for business purposes, but you also use it for private, and you should be taxed on that private element. And that's the one we are talking about today. The car allowance bit we have dealt with, I think, in the last 2 years. The one on the table today is actually the company car one. And we're saying, yes, there's potentially a place in the market for it, and it should be on the same level as an option as opposed to the travel allowance. It shouldn't be overtaxed and killed to that extent. I think that was the questions there on the company car bit.
Thank you, Chair. I think just on the interest exemption, there were two issues with regard to our problem statements that needed clarification. The first issue related to taxpayers being entitled to consistency and certainty, and thank you, Osman, for clarifying that. But I think just to add to that, the way we see it is if an investor took a long-term decision to invest into a business, generally that interest return or the first amount of interest that he would have got up to 22,300 would have been exempt. Now, he's planned his affairs accordingly for that to be exempt. But if this proposal actually goes through, that 22,300 of his first interest income will no longer be exempt. And the issue here is that investor is tied into that investment. If you've loaned money into a business, you can't just recall that loan at a very short term. So whilst he was quite certain at that time because of the tax laws being quite certain, now with the change in proposal to the tax laws, this negatively affects his decision to now invest into this small business. I hope that clarifies that. There was a further comment of clarity sought on the amendment, the question we raised, or the point that we raised, that the amendment favors certain categories of interest-bearing products, and it starts with the fact of free market system. I think where we're talking to this point is that only if you are on the specific inclusion list in terms of the proposed Section 10 Cap C, for example, a bank is included in that specific list, then you will be entitled to that exemption. But if you choose to invest into a business, you will not get that interest. So it clearly seems like if we allow this to go through South of Treasury, can determine where they would like people to invest their funds into. I don't know if they're favoring banks because of the credit crunch, you know, because they've gone through quite tough times. So definitely banks seem to be on that list, high in priority. Thank you. I hope it answers the questions.
If I know you are itching, but you are not going to be given space. I hear the Munir is saying, are you in favor of financialization of the economy? That's the question, but you are not going to respond to this. James.
Sorry, to address, I think, three points. I think, again, the question, just to echo what Osman said as regards share schemes, but we're primarily as a corporate finance advisory house, and certainly we see in terms of our client base that a number of them do have share schemes in place or are looking to put in share schemes, but as Osman said, it's primarily from a commercial reward perspective as opposed to a tax-driven arrangement now. So in that basis, that's where the proposal for equity drives from. The second question was on foreign losses and what I meant there. Just by way of comparison, let's say in South Africa I earn South African interest of 10 and I at the same time do a little bit of trading in South Africa and I make a loss of 5. So my net income then is 5, and in South Africa that's what I'd be taxed on, the 5 differential. I'd be effectively able to offset my loss from my trading against my income, my investment income. But South Africa also taxes my foreign results, and there I'm not allowed to offset my foreign trading loss against my South African income, and I think I could argue till the cows come home that I should be able to do that as well, but that's not what I'm saying here today. I'm saying that if I make a foreign trading loss, I should be able to offset that against my foreign investment income or my foreign capital gains, and as the legislation stands just now, I'm not able to do that. And then finally, there was a question as regards effective dates. I think I referred to two effective dates. I'm not sure which one you're addressing, so I'll be cheeky and answer both. There was the effective date as regards thin capitalization, where we say effectively, all companies that want to make sure they comply with the thin capitalization where they've got a foreign company with a local branch, this law, as scheduled, will come in or will be tabled in final form mid-August with effect from 1 October. So that's a six-week period to restructure and reorganise. I think in that instance, we would look for an effective date starting from the year of assessment commencing on or after 1 January 2011. So for some companies, that will give them 3 months, four and a quarter months, and some companies slightly longer. But the thin capitalization is also something that's determined by reference to year of assessment, so it makes more sense rather than bringing it in partway through to actually align it with that. The other issue that I raised from an effective date perspective was that with the change in dividend definition, which is intended to be taxpayer-friendly but can actually bite retrospectively, that's slightly different. That's something that is transaction-specific. You either buy your shares back or you don't. So that one, whilst it still needs to be prospective, can be fixed with two transactions on or after a certain date, and that one we would have no problem if we said that is effective on date of promulgation or 1 October 2010, whenever that happens to be. It just can't go back on a year of assessment basis. Thanks, Chair.
Any other input?
Thanks, Chair. There's just one question that I want to address, and there was a question on the 30,000 Rand, current 30,000 Rand exemption on a severance payment if one gets retrenched. I think if I understood the question correctly, it was why should that person be taxed more beneficially than somebody that needs to make a retirement fund withdrawal on retrenchment? The only point that we wish to make was, to say that it's not pleasant being retrenched, and what the current proposal is doing is it will increase the tax liability, or it could increase the tax liability of the person that's being retrenched, and I was just wondering whether that was in fact Treasury's intent.
Thank you, Chair. It's not a question. It's just I'm trying to understand what Mr. Smith was trying to explain when he was coming to car allowances. The question from Honourable Tetua, he is asking what happened since you have given us this proposal as the committee doing the oversight to the National Treasury. We also need to understand how the public is feeling about this. What happened where a driver, you even used in inverted commas, you said the tool trade. Now, what happened if at Value Logistics employ a driver and this driver drives 8-ton truck today, tomorrow it's a 4-ton truck today, who is to be taxed? The employer? I can see he's nodding his head. I don't know why, but I think that's what you wanted to know. I didn't get that explanation. Thank you, Chair.
Maybe that's your response. That's on that one. I think the question that was raised by Honorable is also about non-profit making organizations. That's what I would have understood him to be saying. Employees who are then given access to transport to do organizational work. It may reflect as part of an income and the value of the car. How then do you deal with that part? I think from your own understanding, not from Treasury's understanding, from your own understanding of this matter.
Thank you for the question, and I'll try to answer the best I can. Now, as I understood the current legislation and the proposal, if you are being assigned a company car, that is what we refer to as pool vehicles as well. If it is a proper pool vehicle available to all employees, but then very importantly, it mustn't go to your home at night, except if your duties require you to use the vehicle after hours for work purposes. But other than that, the pool vehicle is supposed to stay at the company. If it goes home with you and you're not your duties are not such a nature that you have to use it after hours, then it will constitute a taxable fringe benefit. And that's our problem, that touch on our problem with the tool of trade vehicle, because somebody might use a vehicle basically nearly exclusively for business purposes. He doesn't use it after hours. He's not within the exclusion, but the fact is he must be have the vehicle in the morning to drive to his next job to start working. That's why I take it home with him. He will fall under the current regime, and he will be taxed in terms of this 4%, 3.2% rule currently. So that's why we are asking, for example, for there to be a bit of lenience for somebody in a scenario like that. As far as the non-profit organizations go, the employee, there's no distinction there. The employee in a non-profit organization will be tested according to the same rules. If he gets the use of a vehicle, it's not a pool vehicle, then he will be taxed a fringe benefit. If it's within the definition of this pool vehicle, then there's no fringe benefit assigned to it.
Okay. I think we are on time. We've done very well. I think I've already indicated in terms of the process what is going to unfold from here. It's something that we're all used to. What is going to be critical for us as a committee is the responses that will come from National Treasury to the committee. And they've had the opportunity even to get some sense of a thinking of committee members in terms of a number of issues that have already been asked. I think we'll then tease those issues when we come back more in detail. The issue that was raised by Honorable George is a matter that needs to be responded to when we meet in the committee, the impact
on the fiscal framework of this amendment in relation to as when and how it is going to be implemented. So that is a fundamental question that needs to be looked into. But it's part of the discussions that will be carrying forward. I think this, you have got something?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a housekeeping. Just a housekeeping matter, which I raised before, but I will continue to raise it. I find it untenable that we as members of Parliament are required to amend laws without being provided with the principal acts. And I complain about that last year, I complain about this year, and it is equally untenable that I cannot find a downloadable copy of the Income Tax Act. And in soft copy where I can make amendments, etc. So I think that that's, if it can be attended to, would facilitate our work. If we can get both a hard copy and an amendable soft copy in MS Word.
I think we should just agree that let's attend to that particular concern without debating. I think we are done. Honorable members and the presenters, and thanks to the team, a team that came from all institutions that are here. I must indicate that it's not only what you said to us in Verbatim today that will be taken into consideration as a community. The entire submissions that we've made will spend time going through that as honorable members, so that and as and when we engage with National Treasury, we are also informed by the issue that you are raising. And also just to indicate that there are other submissions that we have received, but we've chosen not to invite everybody here. But those submissions will also go for the same process. Honorable members, you are requested to remain behind for one or two in-house matters that we need to deal with. The rest, thank you very much. You can catch an earlier flight.